This podcast is generously supported by Themis Bar Review. For more information about Themis, check out themisbar.com. That is themisbar.com. Thank you very much. And now back to the show. All right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moyne and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. How you doing, Sam?
Doing well. Tough semester, but always a thrill to be on the podcast.
Yeah. This is a good one, right? Who do we have on today?
We have Will Bode, who's the Harry Calvin Jr. Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School and the faculty director of the Constitutional Law Institute. And we're talking about I would go so far as to say notorious lecture he gave last year at Harvard Law School as the Antonin Scalia lecture called Beyond Textualism.
So a quick warning to all listeners, mostly because I was so excited to get really deep into it, that this is a podcast that you'd do really well to first listen to Will's lecture, which is available on YouTube, or even better, read the essay before you listen to the pod. It gets deep pretty quick, getting at Will's understanding of what the spirit of textualism requires of judges. So with that, let's get to it. All right. We are so excited to have the great Will Bode with us today. Well, we've had people on this podcast who I agree with, and we've had people on this podcast who I disagree with. Heck, Sam and I are on this podcast together, and I don't agree with him about anything. Some good papers and some less good papers. But you can tell that your paper, Beyond Textualism, is a wild, amazing success, because perhaps when we had your frequent collaborator Steve Sachs on the pod, never have I had as frustrating experience reading a paper. For this process. And if you look at my draft of it, there are weird squiggly marks on it. I read it on an airplane and someone next to me actually asked if I was okay. So I want to get into what the source of this frustration, but before we do so, it's important to just lay out the argument. So as I see it, the central claim of Beyond Textualism is that textualism shouldn't be limited to reading text for meaning, but that the insights behind textualism, that judges shouldn't make up rules on their own, and that text is not the same as the motivations for writing text, command judges to do atextual things, or at least things that are not just reading text. For instance, they should require us to apply, judges rather, to apply common law canons of statutory construction, as you characterize the common law as a law that exists outside of judges' opinions, but that is findable and gives us definitive answers to legal questions. So I want to get into that kind of question of what the status of the common law in a minute, but I want to start off with the question, is that all there is to textualism? I would have thought textualism was primarily about democracy. That is to say, the thing that makes the text, as opposed to some other positive command to courts, particularly important, was the fact that Congress passed it and not its mere fixity or otherwise. So isn't textualism really about something that you're not talking about in this paper?
I got nothing against democracy. And I do think that's an important underlying piece of the story of textualism. But I think maybe it's just downstream of some of the things that you just talked about. So I think democracy is a good piece of the story for why, in general, federal judges should do what Congress said rather than make stuff up, because Congress is more democratic than judges. But, you know, old statutes are only kind of democratic. Like the All Writs Act, the Habeas Corpus Act passed a very long time ago. And I regularly get asked questions of the dead hand of the past that would suggest that those aren't necessarily super democratic. So I feel like it's really just this intuition we have that judges shouldn't make stuff up when Congress has done something different. It's downstream of democracy, but not driven by it.
Fascinating. So it's not that it was passed by Congress. I mean, I guess other than that, it's just that it exists and is fixed. There's something wrong with judges making up rules that is independent of the source of those rules.
Well, it's not totally independent. So no, the judge is given a choice between two fixed things they could apply. They could apply a statute passed by Congress or a law review article published by David Schleicher. I think they should go with the statute passed by Congress rather than the law.
Hard disagree on that one.
Even if the Largue article is better, even if the Largue article is smarter, contains better rules, and that is a Democratic story in part, but it's partly also just a story about the rule of law. It's that Congress is the entity designated by our legal system as the one in charge of making rules, even though Congress is only kind of mediocrely Democratic. And certainly, similarly, even if the David Schleicher article was like adopted by a plebiscite of the people, you know, 70% of the American population just like held up the article and said, give us Schleicher. I still think judges would go with Congress.
Ah, fascinating. I, you know, we can agree to disagree on that one. But Sam, you have a...
So I just want to make sure I understand the position. I mean, I think I do, but in this particular article, which is just a kind of a facet or provides a new dimension of a kind of evolving... you know, it's maybe the position you lay out different pieces and different papers. But after the great Jeremy Bentham quote, which I love, you say that there's an insight that drove Antonin Scalia towards textualism, and then everyone else embraced it, including liberal justices like Elena Kagan, famously. And then you say that same insight, that's your phrase, drives you beyond textualism. And I guess I'm trying to understand what is this self-same insight that's doing both things? Because I get that Scalia cared a lot about constraint and was driven to the text in the name of constraint. And you say we can go beyond the text to locate additional necessary constraint when the text, you know, it isn't doing enough work on its own. But I guess I'm not understanding why that's vindicating Scalia's insight. It seems like it's displacing what Scalia cared most about, which has something to do also with judicial power. And I guess, do you really think he would have accepted this, you know, let's say amendment to textualism, or found it abhorrent? Or another way of asking the question would be to ask you why my old you know, colleague John Manning was worried about your title.
Okay, so first let me describe the insight, which is actually incredibly uninsightful and boring.
Okay.
The insight is judges should follow the law.
Of course.
And that's, I think, what... But I think that's really what the insight was that drove Scalia's textualism. The text is the law, therefore judges should follow it. And my extension is just, also there's other law, there's unwritten law, not in the text, judges should follow that too. And it sounds incredibly boring, but that's the core insight, and we often lose sight of it. I will say, because this was delivered as the Scalia lecture at Harvard Law School, there were some Scalia family members in the audience
who I
had to sit with afterwards and have a meal. And I am told that this would not have been regarded as apostasy by Antonin Scalia. You know, we can't ask him, but the closest evidence we have.
Okay, but let me just press you, you know, because they're not authorities on what the man, you know, thought exactly. And we've all read, you know, his various paeans to textualism. And I guess saying that the judges should apply the law, I mean, I'm not sure it's even an insight in the sense that no one disagrees with that proposition. There's just a disagreement about what is going to count as the law. And it seems like Scalia might well have rejected the idea that there's extra textual authority in the general law that will help kind of orient the textualist project. So that seems like the opposite insight from the one that he famously offered. So I'm just trying to understand why it's the same one.
Right. So I do think there are people who disagree that judges should apply the law, or maybe disagree that judges should only apply the law, or disagree that there is law to be applied, or disagree that what judges do is apply the law rather than make it. So there's a family of things that the position, the banal signing position, is meant to reject. I do think you're right that Justice Scalia sometimes wrote as if there were no unwritten law, at least in the federal system, that he was a student of Erie and took Erie too seriously and in the wrong directions. And one of my jumping off points in the piece is his discussion of the common law judge in A Matter of Interpretation, where he describes the task of the common law judge as if it were law free, right? That the judge picks the normative goal they want to reach, and they just kind of, he has a football playing metaphor, but you kind of broken field run through the defenders to get there, do whatever he has to do to the cases. So I do think Justice Scalia sometimes rejected the idea that there was unwritten law that was as thick as the law I describe. Now, it's complicated because even Justice Scalia has like a whole book on substantive canons of interpretation, which he thinks are legally binding, and he tries to describe in that kind of law-like terms. And I, you know, it's hard to know whether the rhetoric of a matter of interpretation Scalia, you know, really controlled all of his own views later, or the Scalia who confronted the alien tort statute, which is probably the area of modern law where the unwritten general law comes up the most. That Scalia seemed to understand there could be unwritten law, but I'll grant you there are multiple Scalias.
So I want to take on the voice of maybe one of those Scalias, or maybe just someone else who thinks Holmes is right and that you're wrong. And so I just want to kind of get into this, because this is the central insight in the move that you're making. If this is downstream from your and Steve Sachs's like disagreement with Erie, and that the law, that I'm right in characterizing it that way. This is all part of one project that's like Erie and yes. The cop. So I recall in one of those pieces, there's a comparison between we can find what the unwritten law is, and it's compared to fashion. We can say what's in fashion. And this has always struck me as a category mistake, because it assumes that it puts me in the same position as a judge in the same position as a person getting dressed. But judges are not like that. They are authoritative deciders in situations, and therefore they're much more like the editor of Vogue than they are like a person. So if you can't say what's in, like, does Anna Wintour say what's in fashion? I don't know. Anna Wintour decides what's in fashion as much as she says so. So what is it that the claim that judges can just merely find this unwritten law, whether it's a statutory interpretation or state contract law, like, it seems to me to have some difficulty with this particular role of the judge in the legal system. So why is it that the fact that judges' decisions are law in the sense that they must be followed, not just in the case, but they have, beyond the case to third parties, like enough to get us past this view of like towards the Holmesian view?
Okay. So the fashion analogy comes from an article by Steve Sachs called Finding Law that I won't totally try to steal here, although I do agree with a lot of it. And I'm not sure how profitably we can pursue the analogy. And you know, I'm no Anna Wintour, but I do think you might put the judge.
This is not a visual medium, but I can guarantee if you could see all of us, none of us are Anna Wintour.
The judge might be more like a high school principal. Like, so Anna Wintour self-consciously tries to like write and predict and change the rules of fashion. Mm-hmm. A high school principal is somebody who commands at a school with a dress code, or any kind of level of the dress code, somebody who commands people to follow some set of fashion rules. Sometimes those are explicit, sometimes they're more normative. But it is true the commands are binding. And in some ways, like all the high school principals start, you know, like declaring some new principle, like girls can wear pants, it will become, you know, it will become part of the norm. But it's complicated to think about what their role is and how much.
Is that how fashion works? That it's just a group of high school principals merely deciding what's fashion and what's not in fashion?
There are many aspects to fashion, but one of them is there are people whose job it is to try to both obey, apply, and you know, coerce others to obey the dress codes. At my school, there are like various sets of norms and soft sanctions about what professors wear, whether students are around or don't, or in the classroom. But you know, judges are somewhere in between Anna Wintour and just like the man on the street. Now, I'll just say, I don't know if this can make it better or worse. I would take a lot of issue with what you just said about judicial rulings having binding effects on third parties. Yeah. That, too, is a downstream of Erie mistake. This is the sort of judicial supremacy idea of the mid to late 20th century. The Supreme Court says, you know, when we speak, that's the same as if the Constitution said it. And therefore, everybody who takes an oath to the Constitution takes an oath to the Supreme Court opinions in the same way. That's very wrong for related reasons. So maybe, you know, maybe this just further shows how big the package is and how much would have to go. If you think of the job of the judge is more like what it classically was, deciding a dispute between two people in front of the judge's jurisdiction, where the judge had power to do that and would try to articulate norms in the course of doing it, but is more like an arbitrator. Like the arbitrator could be right or could be wrong, and the arbitrator's wrongness only in a very small way is going to change the law. Then I don't know that we'd see judges as like Anna Wintour.
Interesting. Again, the which is the one continuation that the common law, the kind of where you're focused on statutory interpretation, is kind of necessarily indeterminate in the bramble bushes type of argument. And so one claim, maybe you disagree, you disagree with that also, but the one question that seems to me that follows from it is that you can ask a question of, is there a problem with judges being self-conscious about the fact that their decisions have the effect of acting like law in a pre-Erie or post-Erie type world? I mean, I think that the characterization of the pre-Erie world as judges as self-conscious policymakers, like, misses a huge amount of what actually happened. Like, if you look at, say, the rules of municipal debt, which was a huge area of Supreme Court Swift versus Tyson era stuff, it was very openly policy-oriented in a lot of ways. And so, I mean, there's some disagreement about this, but we can talk about it. Looking forward to hearing your answer about this. But one question is, like, is there a problem? If we assume there is some policy content they're not merely finding, is there something bad about them doing so in a self-conscious way?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I guess I do think there's part of this is about the mindset. This is about the judge trying not to have the job of policy making and trying to have the job of finding the answers. And that's an important, it's an important version of constraint in some sense. Like, even if you think the judge's choice is in fact unconstrained because either interpretation will be justifiable because the text is ambiguous, I think one important form of almost self-constraint or internal constraint is to say, yeah, therefore I could use this as an opportunity to just do my will, but I'm going to try not to. I'm going to try to find something else. And for democratic reasons, we might want unelected federal judges to be especially eager to put aside their druthers and try to engage in that more limited project.
I know Sam has my other question, but first of all, the main actors here are not on the Erie side, are not unelected state judge, federal judges, but are in fact elected state judges who may have a different set of attitudes towards. But secondly, you move something you don't do in the piece in a lot of pieces, which is like it's a step towards consequentialism, which is like this would be a better set of rules. People would be happier. The country would be wealthier, whatever it is. And that's not what your argument is very much avoid those steps towards consequentialism. Here you're saying it's better because they're self-constrained. Am I understanding that that in fact this is consequentialist all the way down, or is it in fact not?
Okay, so maybe all of us are consequentialists at some deep level, or we're just fighting out whether we're rule consequentialists or some other kind of consequentialists. So the judges should follow the law has a should in it. Maybe the should is consequentialist in some boring downstream sense, but not necessarily in an interesting sense. On judges, I'll just say there's a half defense of Erie that something like many state judges have in fact been vested with sort of de facto legislative power as a matter of state constitutional tradition based on elections and other things about them. To the extent that's true, it doesn't bother me. That's fine with me. So I'm not saying that every state is required to follow the kind of like classical separation of powers model. We might ask some questions about due process and stuff, but I'm fine with that. What's wrong with Erie is the assumption that every state necessarily follows a model where judges are given lawmaking power. And this is not my article, but there's an amazing set of scholarship about this in the context of the Georgia Supreme Court, which continues to openly reject Erie and to insist that they find law and don't make it, and that the 11th Circuit, they tell federal courts, if you are trying to apply Georgia law, don't do what we say. Look for the unwritten law. And then, of course, the federal courts refuse to do it because that doesn't even compute. But that's the kind of thing that I think is the most profound mistake of Erie.
So, I wasn't frustrated by the paper, but I just think maybe outside Georgia, the position you're trying to resurrect has been rendered incredible. And there's the famous language and from Oliver Wendell Holmes in Black and White Taxi Cab and, the Erie decision, cited in the Erie decision itself. But I do want to respectfully explore the position, before we get into whether it's retrievable in our legal culture, just to understand what you believe is possible. So let me first ask about this kind of passing natural law invocation in the Beyond Textualism paper, suggesting that maybe outside the text is natural justice. So one thing I just want to understand is how you can go there if you're a positivist. I thought the position was that constraint is still positive law, even if it's unwritten law. Okay. And then yeah, I thought you all wanted to suggest that, you know, that through reception statutes or whatever, there's the unwritten law would still, you know, be traceable to the proper authority in the jurisdiction. And that was going to be like absolutely central to the constraint you insist is going to make law law. So how can there be natural law at all? And of course, we can get into, you know, the two Justice Chases in this podcast now, you know, Samuel, who I guess is your friend in this regard, you know, flirting with natural law as part of the unwritten law.
So the key is that natural law is binding on courts if and only if it is also positive law, which makes me, I guess, an inclusive positivist rather than an exclusive positivist. When people have that fight, I've always thought the exclusive positivists were incomprehensible and obviously wrong. But the point is that there are principles of positive law, like that could even just be as simple as judges should construe all statutes not to depart from the natural law unless they have to, or something. That could be a principle or a positive law. And if it is, then they follow it. And that's that a lot of the natural law talk you see among judges, the Ira Del Chase debate and a lot of stuff at the founding, is basically that debate. It's the debate about, in our system, to what extent are these natural law principles that they frankly all agreed on, they weren't that interesting. To what extent are they also positive law?
So then you're siding with Iredell in a sense that whatever the status of natural justice, it's not, the judge may not independently appeal to it when he goes beyond the text, or she today goes beyond the text, because it's only a constraint on him or her insofar as it's been enacted by the proper authority.
Well, because there's also unwritten law.
How would it become positive law except through something like a reception statute?
Well, so you could just have straightforwardly customary law. I mean, again, sure, you might have a reception statute, but you might not. We might just have an unwritten rule of constitutional law or state constitutional law that sits alongside the written state constitution that says, don't read a grant of power in this state constitution contrary to natural law unless you have to. That's just a question.
Right. Fair enough. But in some sense, even in the absence of a reception statute, its authorization is still by way of popular sovereignty, on the count you just mentioned.
This is maybe going to get us back to the municipal debt question. Like, so something like the law merchant or customary international law, might be forms of unwritten law that don't exactly have popular sovereignty behind them either. Like nobody in the jurisdiction, the people in the jurisdiction could reject them. They could enact a statute saying we preempt these sources of unwritten law. But even without receiving them, they just are descriptively HLA Hart style part of our law.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. Well, I'm sure there's more there. I want to ask a kind of different version of Schleicher's question about what was really going on in the common law and whether it matches your description, because maybe, you know, you're elevating aspects of what some people thought the common law was about into a kind of myth, even if it is retrievable, that doesn't describe reality. And I think back to, you know, Edward Coke and kind of the kind of people who really in the 17th and 18th century make the common law kind of ideology of governance. And I'm not sure they cared as much as you do, or you say the kind of believers in general law did in the 19th century, about law as constraint. It seems to me they were juristocrats. And what they thought is that, like, to make policy, especially in the intricacy of social life, you needed to be a kind of lawyer, properly educated to kind of make policy, especially in private law settings. And there was no sense in which you were just restricted to, law as opposed to policy making. You were in a sense ruling, and you kind of find a lot of people in our common law tradition, you know, when push comes to shove, who just acknowledge that fact. And so I'm just wondering if there was just a lot of kind of accepted policymaking in the common law tradition before at some point it became kind of, you know, problematic enough that it was happening that the theory of the general law was devised to deflect attention from this fact.
Well, so there are definitely, you know, centuries of different, obviously, changes in common law and attitudes towards the common law, and even the mid-19th century sort of general law tradition might be a little more juris liberating than at the founding era, when, of course, there's more federalism concerns, or maybe even a little more at the forefront. And so, as you know, there's a whole literature on, you know, is Swift versus Tyson consistent with the founding era perceptions about federalism, or is this something that Joseph Story sort of smuggled through and all those things? I'm very interested in those things. Those are the big part of the research project, sort of understand how the common law, general law worked. So I don't have a strong, we can fight about the details. I'm not committed to denying that there's any policy making in those areas. I do think it's just a fundamentally different mindset and a fundamentally different, maybe more importantly, vocabulary than we have in the second half of the 20th century and the 21st century. And so it's a fundamentally different one that now we kind of forget how to read. I also have a project that it turns out this is secretly related to, called The Official Story of the Law, also with Steve Sachs, that in caring about what law is, what we really care about is not what the judges think, but what they say. And so I think a lot of the instances that jump out at us as the judges obviously making policy are ones where it's amazing how much they deny that they're doing that in their official statements. Sometimes in their private statements.
Absolutely. So just explain then, leaving aside, you know, whether it characterized the common law, what you care most about is this law politics distinction that allegedly was kind of broadly accepted before Erie, who knows how old it was. Why is it so important? Just so I completely understand, you know, because that's at the heart of the project, really, that you're trying to get the law politics distinction back and explain why.
So I guess there's multiple levels. So one is, start with the banal one. If we do have the insight judges should apply the law, which, you know, a few minutes ago we thought was so obvious nobody could disagree with it, we're going to need the law politics distinction to understand what the law is. And if there are things that are excluded by the law, that'll be an important consequence of, you know, what it means for judges to apply the law.
Well, no, but only if you assume that the law is not political, which, you know, on this juristocratic conception, you know, in the past or in the present, is something that, it, you know, is not required. Because you could say the law is what, you know, the right agents make in the name of their values. And that's what judges, you know, before this period did, and maybe, you know, in the Warren Court, and so forth. Okay.
Yeah, no, it could be. Two is, if we think textualism was salutary, which is of course the jumping off point of the piece, right? Textualism is relying heavily on the law politics distinction. In a way, this is your way of relabeling Scalia's insight. We might call Scalia's insight was the equally banal law politics distinction. And if we think the law politics distinction has been in the textualism context, has been a salutary revolution of the federal courts, then we ought to think about what else is entailed by the law politics distinction and how it applies to things beyond statutory texts. Finally, the most boring and important scholarly point, though, is because a lot of our law comes from this period, you need the law politics distinction just to make sense of what that law was doing when it was enacted. We could reject it, don't be originalists, reject the Constitution, all that stuff if you want. But if you want to understand the original meaning of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, you need the law politics distinction, because it turns out that the Privileges and Immunities Clause was designed to implement the general law of Swift versus Tyson.
You're alluding to your new Stanford Law Review paper that makes exactly that claim.
Yeah, the dots are all connecting.
There you go. It's the full project. It's so exciting to see it all come together. I want to go back to this question of, like, when. So you mentioned in your answer to question one ago from Sam that, like, the late 19th century judges were pretty juristocratic in Sam's sense. And that's the section of the post-Swift versus Tyson era, which I know the best in this area. And it's very hard to avoid their kind of swaggering policymaker. People very frequently make a line between the the common law making and the reason Lochner-like reasoning in under substantive due process, which is once they were making policy, they were just going to go nuts. So the question is, like, when do you find this, like, so good? Because it's that question is really, really important to your education. It affects lots of to understanding lots of law, because lots of law comes from, say, the second half of the 19th century, you know, 14th Amendment and all that jazz. And so when was this, what is the glory period of common law as law finding?
Yeah. So as you probably know, there's several books about this, and I will tell you, I have recently spent the last month lying awake at night worrying about this. Not so much, not only because I was coming on this podcast and you'd asked me this, but also because of this paper that I've just put out on the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. And so Tony Fryer would tell you that Swift versus Tyson was well-rooted and unanimous, and for about a decade after, it was still the heyday, and then it all started to fall apart in like 1854, he would tell you. Even Holmes, like, maybe dates it to Gelbke, one of these famous municipal debt cases in 1863. I think they're probably wrong, as a competing book by Bridwell and Witten that places the date a little bit later. What I am struck by is a case called Baltimore Railroad Company versus Baugh, decided in 1893. So this is the case where Justice Field, who previously had been one of the big general law people, he's one of the heroes of our general law 14th Amendment paper, because his Slaughterhouse dissent basically argues what our paper argues. In 1893, he writes a dissent saying, this general law thing is actually not a thing. This general law thing turns out to just be the views of the judges. It turns out it's just policymaking. Now, to him, that was bad. So he said, general law is just the judges making policy, and therefore, you know, we in the federal courts should stop doing it. Tony Fryer says that's the first day on which a federal judge explicitly rejects the idea of the general law. Now, you need a couple decades, obviously, of stuff to get somebody to that point, but that's the first place, you know, he's sort of the proto-Holmesian. That's the first place that falls apart.
I'd put it to Miller's dissent in Gelbke, but you know, he changes his own stripes, but his dissent in Gelbke is basically just Holmes in black and white taxicab. It's the same thing.
That's what I lay awake and I worry about is Gelbke. Is yeah. Gelbke the beginning of the dissolution of the general law? Very important to the 14th Amendment paper, if that's true. I'm inclined to think it's not, but that's a totally defensible position in any serious municipal debt person will take.
By the way, that you are now the second person to mention Gelbke versus Dubuque in this podcast, the second after me, because it's a Gelbke versus Dubuque should be much more talked about, should be the center of constitutional law case books. It's an amazing wild case. But I want to ask you this, like, kind of get you into the argument a little bit, which is that, so at one point you make this thing, and Sam kind of referenced this, which is you say you're open to the critique that the old ways of thinking are dead, that an unfortunate casualty of the success of Aryan legal realism. But I'm not sure that the old ways of legal culture are entirely destroyed. And if they were, might it not be our obligation to try to bring them back, which is like a great, unbelievably evocative. And the question is, like, that I don't understand at all, unless you laid out a real strong case that the law would be better. So there are people who make this case. Michael Greva makes a really strong pro-Erie case, basically Erie as something akin to the EU's law, kind of jurisdiction-wide contract law. And it's a powerful argument. Yeah. I don't agree, but it's a very powerful argument. But I can't see why you think it would be better, because again, you can't rely on the original "this is our law" tack here of it. Like, it's just true that if you're requiring us to go back.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is the most anti-positivist moment of the paper. Probably the most anti-positivist thing I've ever written.
Did it hurt? Is it tough?
It felt good. It felt good, but you worry that you're, is it a guilty pleasure? And in saying that, I think the we I'm imagining are like law professors rather than the judges. It's not mm-hmm. clear judges would be entitled to unilaterally bring it back if we're dead. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, I should educate several thousand students that this was a shame that it was gone. So I guess I'll say two things. I'm not positive. I can prove that this would be a good idea. But here are two things that made me think it would. One is I worry that without unwritten law, we end up with these unwritten law-shaped holes in our law that we then fill in ways that don't necessarily work out very well. And I will say I come at this maybe especially influenced by the other class I teach, which is conflict of laws. Once upon a time, we had a general law system of conflict of laws full of rules, memorialized by Joseph Beale in the first restatement. All the law professors thought these were dumb rules, that they could do better, you know, that they, all the standard like legal realist critiques. It was the first place the legal realists really got purchase and successfully got the courts to kill off the unwritten law and replace it with something, you know, more sociological and true and full of normative justification. And the result is just a mess. Sorry, I was about to swear on this podcast. I don't know if you...
swearing is totally allowed.
Okay.
It's a fucking mess. I'm with you. There you go.
A shit show, if you'd like. And, you know, I think that should give us caution about our confidence that we can do better than these kinds of unwritten law principles and make us realize the need for something like that in our legal system.
So that helps me with one part of the better, which is that that's basically a claim for nationalism, right? Which is like the central reason that the conflict of laws rules are bad now is that they're mixed up between the states and undeterminative. And so we would be benefited by having one rule that governs all of the conflicts of law, because that way we could say this a suit brought in Georgia and a suit brought in Michigan between Georgia and a Michigander would end up in one court rather than another under one court's laws, rather state's laws rather than another, regardless of where it was brought. But that doesn't help me with the actual topic of the paper, which is the common law of statutory interpretation, or not, it's a part of that, you know, which is the one rule to govern, we you know, it's treating set rules of statutory interpretation as beyond either statutory command or alternately beyond as a kind of free-floating law independent of maybe anything other than constitutional law, a constitutional change. Strikes me as like not respond that type of answer you give in conflicts of law is not quite, because it's the gains all come from nationalism there.
So okay, so two things. So I don't think the rules of statutory interpretation are beyond the reach of statutes. They are unwritten law, but statutes could change them. So statutes can contain their own rules of interpretation, and they can preempt the unwritten rules of statutory interpretation,
including general rules of statutory interpretation.
Absolutely, a statute can. The point is, and just to generalize, the point is that there are, unless we live in a world of not just perfect nationalism, but in a way like perfect civil law codification of every rule we might ever need for anything in the world, mm-hmm. there will be holes in our law. And even if we did have perfect civil law codification, probably there will be ambiguities in our law. So there will still be holes in our law. And so we need to think about the holes in the law, what the judge's, you know, attitude towards the holes in the law should be. And I think legalism and the law politics distinction has a lot to recommend it in the holes.
As a coordinating mechanism.
As a coordinating mechanism?
Everyone does the same thing.
As a democratizing mechanism, if you will, because it as a constraining mechanism, as a way for judges to try to put aside, you know, it may be, I'll say, that the case would be weaker in a world where we did not have political polarization, or where all of our judges were of sort of like one elite political and social class that all of us were too. Maybe that describes some of the errors in England, by the way, when judges are doing this. Maybe then we'd say, like, look, we're all, you know, like smart, good people, and they are too, and so they should fill in the holes in a different way. But that's a world we haven't lived in for a very long time. So it's partly also as a mechanism of response to our, you know, political situation.
So it's only democratizing if, in fact, for the, let's say, exclusionary textualists, there's sufficient determinacy that there's in constraint in practice. And then for your current position, or let's say the supratextualist addition that you're making, the premise would have to be that what is out beyond the text, including natural law apparently, would also have the same kind of constraining determinacy. And of course, the legal realist, or, you know, let's say crit, would claim that it's precisely in the overstatement of determinacy, you know, and the ideology of legalism that policymaking is best masked by judges, you know, claiming limits. So just how is that dispute going to get resolved? Because that would be a big dispute between, let's say, you and me.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I'm a legal realist as an empirical matter, but maybe not as a normative matter. And I'm not sure I want my judges to be legal realists, to go to one of David Schleicher's point, the self-consciousness points. So I do think the point about masked policymaking is true. I guess I worry that unmasked policymaking is often worse than masked policymaking, because a lot of the implicit restraints and limits on both how much of that happens and you know, all sorts of things about how it happens become much worse.
Well, but that's really an empirical claim that the let's say lying or confusion that in the mask involves it actually leads to greater constraint, because we do lose in the process kind of a clear understanding that judges are doing policymaking, which it sounds like you acknowledge is happening.
Okay, so I totally agree it's an empirical question.
All right.
And that's where, you know, we can look at different areas of the law. Like, I do think the story of a lot of the 20th century is masked policymaking and becoming unmasked and then going wild. Now, maybe it's going wild in a good way, depending on how much revolution you like. I'm also not sure how much we lose. Like, as long as people like you and me are around to read the cases and say what's really going on, I'm not sure we are totally confused. But no, there's a complicated set of questions about like the normative values of transparency,
yes,
you know, and empirically how these norms work, that are all baked into that. I agree.
But those are going to be really crucial to kind of, you know, ultimately decide the biggest dispute, because we really want to know, are we adopting legalism as the kind of ideology of the law that judges do accept? I agree they do and should accept. And that the general public should also, you know, accept, or since it really is, I do think the law politics distinction is widely believed in by the general public.
Yes, those are crucial, but maybe even more crucial, you haven't added this, is just like the legitimacy of the legal system. So to be clear,
right.
This is a good tactic for legitimate legal systems that we think are generally good. If you're kind of small C conservative about those.
Yes.
If they're not, and you're not, you know, then...
Okay.
Then this is going to be bad.
Great. This is honestly, I think you're very close to Judith Sklar's position in legalism then, which is that there was a noble lie going on, but that it led to good results, which is David's consequentialism point. And I just don't think so. But all right, let me turn to another kind of a very different line of inquiry, because I guess it does seem a big step for you to go beyond textualism. As someone kind of, you know, helping lead the conservative legal movement as an intellectual matter. And of course, there's Adrian Vermeule, who is leading it in a very different direction, or proposing to. And I just want to, if I put my kind of Machiavellian realist hat on, which maybe you would allow as, you know, a way of understanding scholarly moves, since apparently you allow them as a way of understanding judicial moves, it seems like there's something going on in this paper, which is about accepting some of Vermeule's abandonment of the kind of traditional view of that the Federalist Society and the conservative legal movement have made famous. Let's say tweaking the kind of standard line, originalism and textualism, in a Vermeulean spirit, of course, reserving the right to then, you know, repudiate Vermeule's book, as you did in the Harvard Law Review, as just going too far to, in a sense, abandon the baby of textual and originalist constraint with the bathwater. And so if that's true, it seems like you all are very close. There's just a kind of, let's say, petty dispute about how centrally to retain textualist constraint, as opposed to all the kind of extra textual, you know, common good principles. And, you know, maybe you'd say, oh, they're in the positive law, just like natural law, but basically, you've updated conservatism in a Vermeulean spirit in this paper. True or false?
After I published this piece, Adrian published a piece declaring victory that the critics of his book had now actually come around to the view of his book, and, you know, So we were actually defeated. And nothing has made me sadder in legal scholarship in my short career as a law professor than Adrian's book. In the sense that, so here Steve and I are trying to uncover the unwritten law that's in the interstices of our written law and trying to convince people that textualists should care about that and that should be a part of the inquiry and that it's not apostasy and all that. Then Adrian comes out with his book arguing kind of the same thing with some weird, a weird sort of like stylistic flair, but kind of arguing the same thing, but insisting that whatever we're doing, he's against that and that we are the leading originalists.
I see.
We don't believe in unwritten law, that we need to be destroyed so we can make great way for his version of that thing instead.
Right.
Part of our reaction all along to the book has been, we would love to be on the same team. Like, we would love it.
Right.
I don't see why his project is hostile to originalism.
Good, good.
He believes it is.
Good.
And we wrote a review saying his project is not hostile to originalism. He wrote a scathing review saying we have so misunderstood the project and are so blinded by our own theoretical assumptions that we can't see why he's so hostile to originalism.
Right.
I guess it's true. And so I still don't see why he's hostile to originalism. So I'd love to have him on the in the club.
Fair enough. I mean, in a sense, you're more open to your proximity to him than he is, just because of his demand to kind of radically excise originalism from a kind of a project you, in a sense, share with him, which is to, read texts in the Constitution within the sea of unwritten law, which may well stretch back, to the classical legal tradition.
Right. Now, in a way, it might be that at the bottom level, we are on polar opposites, in that I'm a positivist. So for me, the question is ultimately, what are the rules of our legal system? And they could be anything. And he is ultimately a normativist, thinks ultimately the question is, what is the common good? And does it happen to produce, do the legal rules of our system happen to produce it?
Well, but that's not totally true, because you've acknowledged that you're both trying to make the common law great again, if you will, and common law mentality. And so you're in this paper, especially, you're kind of on side with him, saying that we need to get back to the good old days. And actually, you kind of agree a lot about what those days involved.
But even then, I'm only there in an interstitial way, not a radical way. Like, if we want to think about Will Bode's radical libertarian utopia, it might have a very different legal system and structure than anything like what we have.
I see.
I'm still seeing this as kind of like one of the things we've lost and misplaced.
Okay.
Whereas he is obviously more of a radical utopian at some like bottom level. But then once you get past that, I'm surprised that our projects are so hostile.
I can imagine in a completely theorized agreement around the project, but not so incompletely, pretty completely, almost entirely completely. So I want to ask a question about, since we agreed to do this podcast and since we got so excited about reading Beyond Textualism, you just happened to drop the single most downloaded law review article in the history of the world. I think in the history, certainly since we've had downloads at least.
No, we're second to Daniel Solov.
Oh, second to Daniel Solov. Is that the article Fuck? Is that the article?
No, that's Chris Fairman. Daniel Solov is I've Got Nothing to Hide. It's like a privacy article.
Anyway, number two ain't bad. It's pretty good.
Who's counting?
Who's counting? Exactly. And the claim in it is that Section 3 of the Constitution bars Donald Trump from running for president. And so one of the things I wonder here is that, like, one of the Bodian moves that you see across these things is kind of that we expect kind of a credulity about judges. Maybe you kind of have a secondary, like, background view, but you believe that judges should be, best interpreted by what they say. There's a lot of research, not like what we assume they are like. There's a lot of research that says that that's a plausible story, except when the stakes of politics get super duper 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 high. Right. So Michael Gilbert's work on the single subject rule is kind of something I think. And this, of course, is the stakes taken to 182. And so I don't have any internal to the case, but I kind of want to use it to talk about what you believe is happening with judges, which is, do you think a judge could read this argument and say, or any judge, any human judge could read this argument and say, that's right. therefore I will rule Donald Trump can't run for president? Or alternately, do you think that could only happen if they are desirous? Like, what's the point here?
The point of the article is to say something true about the Constitution and let people take of it what they may. You know, the target audience is definitely not judges in particular, but, you know, but that said, I think a judge could do that. I think a judge should do that. I'm not holding my breath. So I guess that's part of it is just, I think the job of an academic is to act as if the truth matters. And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Even in my legal realist days, and I'll say my wife is a practicing criminal defense lawyer, teaches on our criminal defense clinic. So nothing makes you a legal realist faster than the behavior of federal prosecutors and federal judges in criminal cases. But even in a legal realist mode, it seems to me that, and again, this may sound like an obvious point, like even in a high profile case, even in the highest profile case, the prosecution of Donald Trump, right? The prosecution cannot walk into the District of Columbia courtroom and say, look, judge, we're Democrats, you're a Democrat, he's a Republican, like we all know how this ends, right? There's like a set of arguments you have to make. You have to be plausible rather than implausible. There are bands of plausibility and implausibility that bite, even in the high-profile cases. So maybe this article only has an effect in moving the bands of plausibility and implausibility. Maybe there are just judges who previously thought the Section 3 thing was frivolous, and now they see it's not frivolous, and maybe it matters. Maybe, you know, the other way around. Maybe there are judges who thought it was in the zone of ambiguity, and they read all 126 pages and see it's open and shut. That'd be great. So I'm not naive enough to think that like there aren't those bands, but whatever the bands are, I just feel like the job is to try to push them towards the truth.
So can I then ask another follow-up question, which is it good? So that's the one thing the article doesn't actually like wrestle with because it's so committed to the positive law project. But I was just left wondering, because normally these articles take one form, which is they say it is true and it is good. And you are very scrupulous about keeping original about not saying, but I want to know, well, like, is it good? Would a self-executing Section 3 be a good rule for a polity to adopt?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, you know, my colleagues have a comparative paper on this, on like the law of democratic disqualification, Tom Ginsburg and Aziz Huck do. And their conclusion, which seems plausible to me, is that it's great when countries don't have to have these at all. That's a sign of a very healthy democracy. But of course, if you don't have a very healthy democracy, you might need a rule like this. If you do have a rule like this, it's really important to have clear procedures, clear rules, like all the things that, you know, which Section 3 doesn't have. And so they say, like, Section 3 would be better if it was not self-executing and if Congress implemented it with some kind of legal code. I mean, I don't know. That's plausible to me. It's plausible to me that would be better. And then in a healthy democracy, it'd be great not to have to do this kind of thing at all.
So I want to, you know, take a run at the paper, you know, kind of in the spirit of earlier questions and just stick with, you know, the politics of scholarship. You've said, you know, judges, you know, according to a kind of charade or noble lie, you know, they may believe it, are supposed to tell the truth about the Constitution and the law. And then in response to David, you just said you wanted to do so. But it's hard to miss the correspondence of your interpretation of Section 3 with your never Trump politics. I mean, which I remember being very eloquently defended in the Real Enemies of Democracy paper. So then I wonder, well, you're telling a truth at a certain moment as a scholarly choice to intervene, and that has to be accounted a political intervention, not just an act of truth telling about the law, which you either, you know is a charade or don't know. And so I guess why not just, you know, tell us that this is an act of constitutional interpretation that's in fact an attempt to forge another political weapon against an enemy of yours.
All right. You're never going to believe this. But when Mike and I started writing the paper, we did not know how it was going to come out. And indeed, we were at least 100 pages into the paper before I became convinced that January 6th was an insurrection. I had to get much deeper into the historical materials on the Whiskey Rebellion and things like that before I saw where this was going. So I actually, for the first 2 years we put in this paper, I actually expected it to have the opposite bottom line on Trump, and to, you know, be much less downloaded as a consequence. So it was kind of to my surprise and therefore like chagrin when I was like, I can't believe this is where we are.
I hate when my legal interpretation ends up reflecting my political priors.
Well, it's maybe the dumbest way ever to write a 126 page law review article is, you know, like if I'd known, you know, it could have been much easier if we'd known that it was going there.
What's sort of incredible though, it will, is that you have to surmount so many obstacles to get to the conclusion that you say was not desired. I mean, among others, now the Chief Justice Salmon Chase's like decision that's, you know, the only precedent on record that which you condemn as wrong. And then the kind of like what was the factual scenario of January 6th within the bounds of insurrection as a legal matter and so forth. And it's like 100 examples like that. And then you really want us to believe the way judges want us to believe that, you know, whatever their politics, or even when it's the same as the one their legal conclusion suits, it's the same with you in this article.
I mean, you can believe what you want. I will say no serious person could think Chief Justice Chase is right in Griffin's case. Like that, okay. That's where the article started. It was just like, this cannot possibly be right. Maybe that's all we need to say about anything. I'll say the thing that gives me the most pause with the article is our discussion of free speech and the First Amendment. You know, we come to the conclusion that Section 3 kind of like implicitly preempts free speech principles, which as a free speech person, I don't like and makes me very nervous. And I think about Bond versus Floyd and like could we have a third Red Scare. I don't like that. Now, you know, you might just say, all right, that was one more casualty in my quixotic quest as a law professor to somehow dethrone the next president of the United States. But there you go.
I have to say, I find whatever the underlying justifications, the self-justification results in unbelievably brilliant and fun articles to read. This was a huge pleasure getting to dive into the complete outworks of Will Baud today. We didn't get through everything, of course, because there's almost an infinite number of articles. But this was, as I like to say, a real clam bake. This was so fun, Will. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.